is it that time already? I need to put this instrument down. Hello there. How are you? How is your drive time commute? Where are you right now listening to this podcast? I'm really fascinated by that. Have you finished your coursework? Have you started your coursework? What three sources have you chosen to use? All very important questions, I think. Let me know, drop me an email on hello@historyrocks.co.uk. We are, I think, 50-odd days from the first exam. Can you believe it? It's coming up, May. It's coming up really quickly. So if you haven't already created yourself a bit of a revision plan, now is definitely the time to do it. Because if not now, when? When are you going to do it, if not now? Starting with a little joke. This one you're going to have to think about, but it's funny. Trust me. I know you thinking like her jokes are really bad usually, but trust me, this is a good one. Early in the morning, Eric Honecker arrives at his office and opens his window and he sees the sun and he says, "Good morning, dear sun." And the sun replies, "Good morning, dear Eric." Honecker works and then at noon he heads to the window again and he looks at the sun and says, "Good day, dear sun." And the sun replies, "Good day, dear Eric." And in the evening, Eric calls it a day. He's had enough. He's done many, many hours of work. And he goes back to the balcony again and again looks up at the evening sun and says, "Hello, dear sun." And the sun is silent. And Honecker's like, "Good evening, dear sun." Still nothing. So he shouts up at the sun, "What's the matter?" And the sun replies, "You can kiss my..." I'm in the West now. Get it, Eric Honecker? East, Germany, West, sun sets in the West. It's brilliant. It is brilliant. Well, let's take a quick stock of where we've got to with these Cold War special podcasts. We've covered quite a lot, if you think about it. Fair amount of ground. We've looked at all of the developments just prior to World War II, the long-term causes of the Cold War, which we said there are many. We've looked at the wartime itself and all of the problems between the Allies and the tensions that arose then. We looked at the Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe. And, of course, the Americans and their development of containment. We've looked at the development of the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine. We've looked at, how the Americans have tried to help Europe. We've also recently looked at the Berlin blockade following all the reforms in Germany and obviously the consequences of that and how significant it was in the development of the Cold War. So we're moving on. We're moving swiftly on. I guess the thing to add to that, the thing definitely to look at, is the fall of Czechoslovakia in 1948 to communism. It's definitely important because it is seen as the last bastion of democracy in Eastern Europe. And when that fell, it was a major concern to the Americans and to the West. But really, that was the last country in Europe to fall to communism. After that, there's no real change really within Europe. All the attention now is going to shift to Asia in particular. What we call the widening of the Cold War. And it starts with China. And that's what we're going to look at today. Quick overview of what happens in China. China is so important because the loss of China for President Truman was seen as such a major embarrassment, such a humiliation, that all of the presidents after Truman are so keen to avoid what he's done, to not duplicate the mistakes that Truman had made in China. So you'll see all of the American presidents are absolutely keen to commit to Korea and obviously what's going on in Vietnam, etc., etc., because of their fear of repeating the mistakes of President Truman, who was now seen as soft on communism. So how does all of this flare up? Well, actually, the Chinese Civil War had been going on for such a long period of time. It'd been going on since the 20s, the end of the 20s. So it raged, I think, between 1927 to 1949. And it was fought between the Kuomintang, or KMT, which is the nationalist movement, and the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP. And basically, they've been fighting each other for a long time. During the Second World War, Japan kind of rolled in and took control over the area. So they were sort of fighting Japan as well. When Japan pulled out of China following their defeat in World War II, bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and all of that, it led to a full-scale civil war in the region. So the Kuomintang, the Chinese nationalists led by Chiang Kai-shek or Chiang Jieshi, you might see that pronunciation of the name, was basically given a fair amount of American support under President Truman to prop it up against the Chinese communists. They were quite a corrupt movement. They refused to sort of bring in reforms that the Americans were pressuring them to do. I mean, I guess the thing we've got to take from this is that the American foreign policy gets a bit muddy after World War II and what developments in Europe. Frequently, they'll support governments or parties that are not necessarily, because they're non-communist, they're not necessarily democratic. And you see this throughout, actually, Southeast Asia, I think. So Chiang Kai-shek has got this backing then from the Americans against the Chinese communists. Mao Zedong, or Mao Zedong, is the leader of the Chinese Communist Parties. He's been leading the resistance against not only the KMT, but the Japanese. And consequently, he's earned an awful lot of respect, particularly in the north. He's got a lot of support in the north, mainly rural areas, places where, you know, he's managed to liberate from the Japanese occupiers. And when the Japanese left, there was a huge amount of weapons, actually, that were seized from them or, you know, taken over. And so they have an army of about 1 million people. They are outnumbered, actually, by the KMT. They are outnumbered by the KMT, but they have an army of about 1 million people. They are taking on an army under the KMT of about 3 million, I think, by the end of 47, there or thereabouts. So they've been raging. The Americans are supporting the KMT. They're ploughing in about, I think, $200 million worth of funding to the KMT by 47. The Soviet Union basically tells Mao to form a coalition government with Chiang Kai-shek. This might surprise you. You know, all those documents that seem to suggest that Stalin is sort of the architect of the spread of communism across the globe, not just Eastern Europe, but across the globe. Stalin was reticent on this issue in China. He was encouraging Mao to create a coalition government so that it didn't upset the West. And he was, you know, he didn't really have much involvement at all within the Chinese Civil War compared to the Americans, and was probably pleasantly surprised when the communists actually won in 1949. So, raging war between the two, the Americans really backing then the KMT, despite the KMT being stronger, having this support from the Americans and having a larger army, they lose. There's a lot of desertion amongst their own army. And basically, the Chinese communists were able to capture Beijing by April 49. And then Nanjing fell. And consequently, Chiang Kai-shek had to flee to Taiwan. So Mao basically, by October of 49, declares the setting up, the establishment of the People's Republic of China, and the Americans refuse to recognize it. And that's going to be important, actually, when it comes to Korea later on. So why is the Chinese Civil War so significant to the development of Cold War? Well, firstly, it shifts the Americans' focus, as we were saying before, away from Europe, because the last country to fall was Czechoslovakia, now to Asia. This is going to become a big thing for them. They are now going to be supporting and aiding Taiwan in a major way, which, of course, they wouldn't have done before. It's just a tiny little island off the coast. Equally, we said before that President Truman was seen as being soft on communism because he lost China. He took the blame for that. And all of the presidents after him are going to be absolutely keen to avoid a repetition of what he did. I think actually it helped trigger a wave of McCarthyism in the United States, because by 1949, rightly or wrongly, by 1949, the Americans were genuinely fearing that they might be losing the Cold War. They had lost China. Of course, we know what's happened across Europe and the spread of the Soviet Union there. They thought that they had the nuclear monopoly up until 1949, when the Soviet Union managed to develop their first atomic bomb, which was far earlier than the Americans ever predicted, much, much sooner than they ever predicted. So that really shook them to the core. Although they, of course, were, I guess, triumphant during the Berlin blockade, they were fearful, the Americans were fearful that, you know, Stalin might try this again at some point in future. It made them feel uneasy. So there was a genuine fear that they might be losing the Cold War, that the Soviet Union might be slightly ahead in terms of stockpiling of weapons and nuclear weapons, and that, you know, they were losing their grip a little bit. So McCarthyism, well, that's a whole topic in itself, but that's when Joseph McCarthy came forward, as a US senator, came forward with a list of people he reckoned in the American government that were collaborating or sympathizing with communists. And this led to a whole witch craze across the United States of America, where people were accused of being communist sympathizers and investigated by the House of Un-American Activities. So this continued really all the way up until sort of him starting to accuse the military under President Eisenhower, and that was like a step too far, and basically he ended up being, well, he lost support, lost confidence, and ended up being isolated, became a drunk, and died. So that was the end of McCarthy. But I do think the loss of China and that unsettling sense that it brought allowed McCarthyism to take hold within the United States. We also get the publication of a very important document called the National Security Council Report, NSC 68. And this basically suggested that the Soviet Union was intent on spreading globally. And it advised that there should be a big expansion in conventional and nuclear weapons. Conventional is just like ordinary weapons alongside nuclear weapons. And that they should be really supporting reconstruction of Japan. Now, Truman parked this report really until Korea, because he didn't want to splash out the amount of money that it would require to see through those recommendations. And finally, I guess the last thing that's important on the back of this victory of the Chinese in 49 is the fact that we get a Sino-Soviet Treaty of Friendship that's signed between the two countries in 1950. So you've got an alliance now being formed between the Soviet Union and China, two enormous countries, which of course again shakes that American confidence even more. Right, okay, so that's a little bit on developments after Europe, I guess, and into China. I hope you found that useful. Do keep working, keep revising, keep going for it, and I'll speak to you soon. Take care.